two questions I'd like to put on the table. One, my name is Susan Sagert from the CUNY Graduate Center. One of those has to do with putting on the table to rethink in this context forms of ownership and to open up what, in fact, property ownership means, and particularly for cities, what land ownership means, and to not fall into, like, there's only one form of ownership, to get more real and more varied and more critical and multifaceted about it. The other thing I'd like to raise as a concern with the network society idea is that sometimes it's less hierarchical only in the sense that no particular individual has either a lot of power or a lot of accountability, but in fact, the accountability is built into some kind of a systems function, perhaps even a computerized technical function, which has no accountability, and even the people who are supposed to be implementing it sometimes don't even know when it's kicking in, and they themselves may be the one who gets kicked out.
Richard. I'd just like to make an observation on the two parts of this morning. And a slight criticism, I would say, of how people on the sort of social science, economic planning side of this respond to architecture, which is that I think what's happening in the architectural world today is an attempt to rethink in terms of visual form issues that we as sociologists, economists, planners, people involved in politics, put in a very different compartment and think we understand questions like identity, flexibility, and so on. Now, we don't expect Dayan or Hashem to compute for us. But it seems to me interesting that it's very difficult for us to look as they look, that is, to try and understand what something like identity looks like physically, and why identity might be a bad thing when you look at it as a physical object, or the ways in which flexibility can actually be rethought as a political process, or a network can be rethought as a visual object. There is often a kind of misplaced practicality I found among urbanists, where when we see people thinking in a different way or using their imaginations, or using their art to reconceptualize issues that we feel we understand because they're solid and they're on the ground, we push it away and say this doesn't bear on us. And my own feeling about this is that so many of the things we take for granted, as planners particularly, lead us to dead ends. We keep producing the same stuff over and over again. That it's very important to try and get out of that mindset, that kind of, and try and reimagine. And I would invite you, in the course of the next day and a half, think about that. We have great architects here, Rem, Alejandro Zarapolo. We have people who have really tried to make the physical world, not represent it, but make it. And that implies critique and rethinking, I think, a great deal of the stuff that we do. So I guess my comment is that our discussion seems to me, as an urbanist, to reflect a kind of separation that's bad for us who are on the so-called practical, real-world side of this. These are people who are asking us, you know, to be self-critical in a way that I think would be very valuable.
Hi, I'm Deborah McCoy from University of California at Berkeley, the Center for Cities and Schools, and I just wanted to make a quick comment that I so appreciate the diversity of and the range of perspectives and viewpoints on the urban age, but I think it's also really important that we as a community that really cares about the future of cities, to think about how do we collectively prepare the future generation for the city that we are talking about and envisioning. And what is the impact of all these different sectors and the way to help prepare the future generation through the public school system? I'm also a graduate, a third-generation graduate of the New York City public school system, and someone really committed to public schools. And I think that when we think about the health of urban cities, we far too often keep schools isolated from that conversation.
Right.
I'm not going to repeat what Brad and Jonathan said. I thought it was excellent. I want to address what Richard just said. I do believe architects and all of us should be rethinking identity and flexibility, but I think we shouldn't forget about how we can use architecture to generate social inclusion and equity.
I'm Harvey Mollich from New York University. For me, the elephant in every city's room, especially in the United States, is the nation state, and the degree to which cities, even if they had the autonomy that other cities have, that New York lacks, have capacities to make the kinds of interventions effectively that have been spoken of. So the specificities, a few of them have been alluded to, the infant mortality in New York, it's also other parts of the United States, similar data would be present, the potential of global warming. When you nestle in the fact that there's been so much emphasis accurately on flexibility, adaptability, then the question becomes, how can you, at a national or even global level, set the context through which this flexibility can occur without creating the damages that also have been alluded to? And so one of the things that I think needs to be on the tables is the interaction between the local and the national state, and in some form the international state, as a way of, I'll use the word regulate, what is going on without killing the goose of, that is laying the golden eggs of creativity. And that seems to me to register a new type of way of thinking about regulation that is different from the way prior generations have thought about state intervention, but creates a kind of agenda for thinking about the relationship between the local and the political global.
What I'm addressing here in some sense has been articulated by Harvey and also by Richard Sennett, and it's the contradiction in a way of these two points that's troubling me about the discussion in the last two sessions. I feel a little bit like there's a confusion in the room, to be honest, which is to say we haven't articulated really what we want from cities at all. As we start this or continue the conversation. And what I mean by that more specifically is, do we want cities to be problem solvers in some ways? And then what do we mean when we say city? Do we mean the city government per se? And that's getting really at Harvey's issue. It's a difficult articulation to lay all of the issues of inequality and everything else that's been put on the table here, and even the failure of imagination to local city governments per se. And so I'm a little concerned that in this effort to think more broadly and creatively and reconceptualize, that we focus a little bit on who we want to do what, frankly. Who are the problem solvers? Who are going to be the service providers? What level of government is going to do this, if it's government at all? Are there roles for other actors in this system that we're talking about here, and that we have to really confront a realistic issue, particularly in the United States, but I think it's global in context, that there's competition among cities. I was talking to Jerry Frug here about the issue of structure that he put on the table. Something that I'm very familiar with is what happened in Lower Manhattan Somebody asked me, is Jersey City good for New York? Well, you know what? From a parochial perspective, I would say, no, it's not. The jobs were sucked out of Lower Manhattan and moved over to Jersey City. It didn't create more opportunities for the people who got left behind and who were unemployed. So there's a structural problem here that really isn't being clearly articulated, I think, in terms of what we're focusing on and, you know, what we want from the city and who we want to do it.
Hi, Michael Sorkin, local architect. If I could follow up on the last remark of Jonathan Rose, I note in the organization of this program a big lacuna, as they say in Hawaii, and that is there's very little reference to the environment in the structure of this program. This seems absolutely critical to me. I mean, the gorilla in the room. Surely it's an issue that ramifies in terms of a series of topics that we're taking up, including economy and transportation. But I'd like to focus for a moment on the way in which thinking about cities in terms of sustainability and environment has an implication for the notion of the autonomy of cities, which is something that's being much discussed here. I get the sense that in the economic panel, we're essentially accepting the neoliberal global economic agenda and thinking about cities as reactive mechanisms. So, for example, it goes without saying that there are no more manufacturing jobs in New York, but the implication of this is unexplored. The fact that we all sit here wearing shirts made in Korea, shoes made in Indonesia, and carrying blackberries made in Taiwan, has a series of important meanings for the environment. Equally, in terms of framing the idea of urban autonomy, not simply in terms of structures of governance, but in terms of its relationship to the environment, I think new strategies of self-sufficiency formulated in terms of environmental strategies and meetings are absolutely crucial. You know, we talk easily about the desirability of being able to walk to your job. On the other hand, Enrique and I were at interesting conference in Australia where the following statistical tidbit struck me, which was that in order to send one kiwi fruit from New Zealand to London, it requires the production of 5 times the weight of the fruit in greenhouse gases. Small example, but not a trivial one. And I think that we must be a little more inclusive in terms of this looming crisis in our discussion of the future.
There's been a lot of discussion also about job growth, zoning, art, and entertainment in all of this, but I haven't heard much discussion to really address as another problem, which is as we transform older, decaying neighborhoods, certainly here in New York City, I know also in London, a lot of success stories of taking old industrial neighborhoods and transforming them into new, vibrant communities, whether it be for artists or new forms of manufacturing, new forms of entertainment. And how do we, I mean, the interesting talk about forming equity for people is a very good one, but how does this group really address that issue? As cities need to evolve, need to rebuild themselves, yes, we need to preserve some of the old architecture, we also need to continue to evolve in new urban ways. And there are influx of new opportunities for all kinds of new immigrants and all kinds of people, and how do we address that tug of war that always goes on?
Any other comments?
Just, of course, it's hard to tell where the conversation's going, but there is a lot on the table here, and the discussion about flexibility is quite interesting. What I'm thinking about is how flexibility has these two sides, and I think perhaps inherently two sides, and the one is creativity, and we can see that in a number of ways, but the creativity seems to be, at least in this country, seems to be at the cost of destruction. For example, the flexibility in the property market comes from the fact that you build a shopping center and your investment is, you wouldn't do the investment unless you could amortize it in 5 or 10 years, and if it closes down in 10 years, that's okay, and it gets written down, and we have policies that allow those costs to be very widely shared. And so it's by abandonment in part. That's a destructiveness in the way that we organize flexibility in the use of space. And the same is true, I think, in terms of the flexibility in the workforce. The destructiveness, I have a son-in-law who's just losing his job as a security guard, which isn't much of a job, but it was a job that had health insurance. The company, flexibility is resulting in the exchange of the property to another company that's going to be non-union and isn't going to have health insurance. You know, there's a destructiveness in the way that we close down existing work organizations and replace them somewhere else or even in the same place with other organizations. And the costs, I guess that's what's the most interesting, and several people have alluded to the social costs. They seem to me to be inherent. I don't know how we're going to get around it. And what bothers me is when we use the term flexibility and have the positive spin and it's flexibility and creativity, that we do have a tendency to just buy into that one side of it without asking, is there a way, is it not inherently also destructive at the same time?
I've got Dieter, Enrique, and one in the back. And then I'll check with Ricky about timing and so forth.
Yes, I would like to refocus on our basic question we started off, do jobs build cities and do cities build jobs? We can start very traditional and say, well, jobs are created by investments, and then cities are created. But that's not very satisfying for structuring the city. So the big chance, and what was the thesis of our discussion, is that the situation has changed. That today the city is a precondition of the functioning of the labor market of the economy. So we can start to make a context policy for creating equality of the city. This is a precondition of jobs. And there it would be, I think, this. I also would like that maybe Saskia make the link between the local economy she was discussing and this basic idea that now cities are building jobs. That means cities are not, what's a city? The city is the city as a social context with an untradable economic, effects. So the precondition of the specific productivity of the city, the city is a brand of in this aesthetic appearance, if the social coherence, it's a very, very complex system. And we can intervene in all the different fields. Also city, as Sharon has pointed out, as a cultural context. But how can we shape the culture? How can we make secure that culture will be sustainable? That all the problems we have, that the effects and the main dynamics which create the quality of city are always in danger to be destroyed by the successful city. So if the cultural activities, they create a certain attractivity, and then the dynamic comes and the people are thrown out. So how we can react on this? What are our instruments? Is it a strategy of a land use strategy? Or how can we do it? So this, I think, are the basic questions we should discuss. For we have this dialectic, we have the new chance that the city creates jobs, but then the dynamic of the jobs are always in danger to destroy the qualities which have attracted the jobs. And how can we come to a sustainable city in the sense of a social sustainable city, but also on an ecological sustainable city, as you have pointed out, that we have to be aware that we will be faced with the problem of mobility based on gas. So we have to create already a structure that we don't fall in a hole.
I have been told we really have only time for one more comment. So Enrique, why don't we close out and then figure out where we go from here.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say that I will refer to city as the urban area, because even here in the comparison between London and New York, it was presented as a universe that did not exist, or if it was something apart. So it's not the political microphone. So it's not the political issue that interests me, but the whole urban area. here it was also in reference to whether cities create jobs or not. Referring to the question that S.R. Fox addressed, what is it we want cities to do? And I think that we want cities and we want everything that we do to create happiness. Happiness is a very elusive word because we don't know exactly what it means, and it's difficult to define it and more difficult yet to measure it. Yet we cannot forget that this is what the whole thing is about. We want jobs because we want happiness, we want equality because we want happiness, we want so. Even if it's very difficult to refer to it and difficult to measure it academically, I think we cannot forget about it. And again, so I will make just two references in terms of creating jobs and equality. I think there may be many factors that have to do with job creation, but here we are referring to that which cities can do to create jobs. And I just think that clearly, if presently businesses are trying to seek great people, quality people, even more than before in the industrial era, clearly businesses have to go where people like to be. It's different than before when a corporation such as Dow Chemical would create its headquarters in the middle of nowhere in Michigan, and anybody who wanted a job had to go there. Now, people, it seems, they have to go where people want to be. So quality of life is critical, it seems, and for a developing country cities as well, but for any city. But the question again now is how to define quality of life. And then we can go to something that has to do with public space, which is a lot of what cities have to do. And again, this has to do with equality. We, in the worldwide, we have adopted capitalism today. And we, in a more and more integrated global economy, countries cannot create equality simply by having much higher tax rates than others, for example. So this is becoming more and more a given. So, but cities can create a lot of equality if public good prevails over private industry. And I'd like to give examples. If everybody at least has to use public transport because car use is restricted somehow, then at least you get some sort of integration and equality in public transport use. If public good prevails over private interest as an essence of democracy, for example, the hundreds of miles of waterfronts that New York has, then we'll create a lot of equality. I mean, it's maybe not necessary that everybody will have to have equal income, but everybody will be able to go ride a bicycle in front of a waterfront. If we don't have private, nice private houses in front of Long Island Sound, but instead nice pedestrian public walkways or bikeways. I mean, I don't know if why is these new schemes that are privately financed schemes to finance park maintenance clearly make a difference when Central Park is like a jewel and maybe the Lower East Side parks much less so. So if we want to create equality, maybe this is important for equality, it's important for competitiveness and for job creation. So I just say that even though there may be many other variables relating to happiness, relating to job creation, in order to, for the context of this meeting, quality of life, I think is can be very relevant, and particularly public spaces, quality of public spaces, I think can be interesting, and this is relevant for all cities, for New York and for all cities in the world.
Okay, we have two challenges. The first is logistical. We have to go to lunch, and then we have to decide, I guess there's some sense about taking the bus up to Harlem later. People need to sign up now. Because the bus leaves from here, it either goes through the Excelsior Hotel or goes direct to Harlem. So where do folks sign up? That's
one of the transportation so-called experts, you can take the 2 or 3 right to 125th Street, and it's there, and it's
better.
The best way to go.
So I guess where do we go to lunch?
That was my talk.
Right outside. And I my sense is when we come back after the lunch speech, maybe we rearticulate some of them.
Right.
I agree.
think of that. I think of it. Take the N and R, right? Yeah.